This short and beautiful psalm has always been one of my favorites. In fact, it was a psalm I took for my very first sermon the evening that I was ordained in Seven Oaks Parish Church more years ago than I like to remember. I remember that I then suffered from that disease of having to make all your points have alliteration, so that the result is that I can actually remember that sermon. I can remember practically none of my other sermons over 30 years. I preached on the sower's seed, the sower's sorrow, the sower's sheaves, and the sower's song. That's not copyright. You may have it if you want it. Since then, the psalm has been used very greatly in times of revival in the Christian church, and was a favorite psalm in the Hebrides in the 50s when revival came there. And I often ask the Lord if next time revival could be a little nearer London. But it does, of course, wonderfully express, doesn't it, the joy of people who see God at work. When God came to us and restored our fortunes, we were deliriously happy. We were shouting with joy. We couldn't get over it. It seemed unbelievable, like a dream. I took this psalm on Wednesday night when I was in Durham at a great call to prayer there that some of the churches got together. And I took some of the balances in this psalm, which I think focus around a call to prayer, which of course is in verse 4, when the psalmist cries to God to do for us today what he's done in the past. I haven't time to say all the things that I said in the Northeast on Wednesday night, because there isn't time in a communion service on a Sunday morning. But I'd like to look at some of those balances rather briefly with you this morning. And the first lovely balance in the psalm is the balance between memory and hope. You see, if you look at verses 1 to 3, it's all taken up with memory and the past. The psalmist looks back into history. Nobody seems to be interested in that today. It's very important if you're a Christian to read Christian history. He looks back into history not so very long ago. Today is when God restored the fortunes of Zion. It's impossible now to locate the particular historical moment that he's talking about. Now he stands in days which are more barren and cheerless. And so he calls upon God to restore our fortunes today, just as he did in the past. He's actually asking for a miracle, because the Negev in verse 4 is the southern desert, and the idea of watercourses there is absurd. So he's asking God for rain in drought, which seems impossible. Now, verses 1 to 3 are not just nostalgia. It's very important to realize that the psalmist is not looking back to this great time of revival when God restored the fortunes of his people. He's not looking back and saying to the young people, well, the old days were good indeed. That kind of nostalgia actually is weakening rather than strengthening. He does it in order to give hope. One great Christian leader has said that that in terms of his reading, he lives in the 18th century. The reason for that, of course, is that the 18th century is the great century of revival, the most recent time in our history when God has come to a society more or less hopelessly given up to humanism and atheism and has revived the churches, as he did through John Wesley and George Whitefield and many others. There's never been a time of revival like that since. And Canon Christopher of St. Aldate's, a rector of St. Aldate's long before Michael Green, used to take Bishop Ryle's story of the 18th century, Christian leaders in the 18th century, used to take it away with him on his holiday every August. And sitting on the beach with his bucket and spade and grandchildren, he would read through Ryle again and think of those great days which would give him hope that there was still a God who could restore the fortunes of his people. A cross-reference that may bring this kind of memory to life is to turn over to the revelation of John and chapter 2. So keep a finger, please, in Psalm 126. And I don't think there can be a Christian who reads through the letters to the seven churches who isn't chastened and moved by the letter to the church at Ephesus. It's a good church, a patient church, and a faithful one. And a hard-working one as well, as verse 3 shows in chapter 2 of Revelation. Verse 4, but I have this against you, says the risen Christ, that you people at Ephesus have abandoned the love you had at first. Somehow, that glorious zeal that first love after conversion had disappeared. The hard work was still there, but the heart of it had somehow gone. And so in verse 5 he says, "Remember then from what you have fallen, repent and do the works you did at first." In other words, he says, remember. Remember what you were like when first you heard the gospel, when first Christ came to you, when first you tasted the joys of sins forgiven, like that young man that we read about in the gospel today. And then notice what he says, not feel the feelings that you had at first. That's always a will-o'-the-wisp, isn't it, trying to get back those feelings. It's do the works that you did at first. How eager you were to get up out of bed, weren't you, when first you knew the Lord. And now, well, it's all a bit of a battle and rather more duty than delight to pray. So he looks back, you see. Looks back to those days when God had moved. And it gives him hope that God can move again like that in his life. Indeed, it gives him a great desire that God would lead, move in his life like that. I wonder if it's happened to you. Probably you're too young, many of you, but those of you who are older will have nephews and nieces, if not your own children, or at any rate friends, who come to you to have tea or a meal, and you haven't seen the children for 3 or 4 years, and you find yourself saying, before you bite the words back, "How you've grown, Matilda," or whatever the name is. Children don't very much like it, do they? But it's impossible not to notice the tremendous change that 1 year or 2 years can make. As you look back into the past, however, in the church's life, you're much more inclined, if you go back into history, to say of the church today, "How you shrunk." Now, that's a very important thing to understand. Because many good things are happening in the church in our country today. There are signs of new life, especially amongst young people. We can see joyful things happening. We can see Bible weeks with thousands of people going there. We can see churches full of joy and life. We can see Christian unions that are the biggest societies in the university, and so on. And it's very easy, looking around, to take comfort and feel that all is well. Whereas if you look back, you have to say about the church in the 20th century, in the last quarter, how you shrunk, at least the church in the West. I went to Peter Jones recently to get some new blinds for my kitchen. And I compared the old blinds, which I took along, with the new ones that were on offer. And there were a number of ways in which the new blinds were very inferior. I don't know what they call it, you ladies will know, but there's a kind of thing at the side where they turn it over and stitch it. A hem, isn't it? So I said to the girl behind the desk, "Don't they have hems today?" And she looked at me as though I was half-witted. I said, "No, there's nothing like that today." No, indeed not. I was in a house where they'd been rewired. And the work of the man had been done very willingly. But compared with how people would have done it 30 years ago, it was something of a botch job. Service in shops the same. If you're young, you simply don't know what service means. Today, you're very likely to be told to go and fetch it yourself and to find out the price and do all the work, and you finish by saying thank you. Nobody says thank you to you. If you're under the age of 25, you have no idea what service used to mean. And so you could go on, you see. It isn't a matter of nostalgia or older people being rather superior. In our country, in practical ways, there's been a decline on all sorts of fronts. But how much more over a century in the church? Let me list some of the things. I mentioned 7 when I was at Durham in that rally, but let me mention 4. I hasten to say that I rejoice at all that is going on. The church journalists think that I'm a great prophet of gloom. And if you read the Church of England newspaper next Friday, almost certainly if there's any report on what I said in Durham on Wednesday last, it'll be that I had gloomy things to say. People like to typecast you, don't they? In fact, I spent a great deal saying how I thought good things were happening. But I did say, if you look back, you get a better sense of perspective. Let me mention 4. First, the dismantling of Christian ethics. Now, we know that Christian ethics are being dismantled in the world. If you live in the city, you'll know that through the latest Lloyd's scandal, a thing that would have been very difficult to conceive 40 or 50 years ago. On my desk yesterday, I found the agenda for our next deanery synod here in the city churches. And we are discussing, because one or two clergy and laymen have insisted we discuss, otherwise it is certain we should not, homosexual activity in the church. At the same time, when I got in yesterday, I had a letter from the rector of St. Bartholomew's Aldgate. I think I can mention his name now because he's quite unashamed in it, and indeed is the leader of gay liberation and has the literature on his desk, which explains why I've discouraged many of the young people in this church from working there. He sends round a paper that he proposes should be read by people before our next deanery synod, saying that it's time the church woke up and accepted this kind of sexual activity. Now that would have been unthinkable 20 years ago, let alone 30 or 40 years ago, unthinkable even 5 years ago. You can be sure that our deanery synod meeting, when it comes up next month, will be a time of total confusion, because the clergy don't know what authority now to appeal to. And if any member of the staff of St. Helens were to get up and say that the Bible teaches this, that, and the other, the answer would be, well, how can we believe the Bible? Therefore, if you look back, you see, as he does in Psalm 126, you're bound to notice a tremendous decline in Christian ethics within the church. A disastrous decline, you may think. Secondly, you'll find a distortion of Christian mission. You will find today that economic salvation is often put forward in the church as what we're all really about. Lazarus today, as a recent writer at the time said only last week, Lazarus today is unlikely to be suffering, at any rate in Europe, from an empty belly, but he may be dying for lack of spiritual nourishment. This same writer in the Times last week said that in his local bookshop there were three great sections of religious literature. There was the Christian literature, there were world religions, and another third given up to spiritualism and every conceivable type of flotsam and jetsam that people go in for today in spiritualism and the like. It pointed, he said, to him as he walked round that popular bookstall at home to the tremendous hunger amongst young people while the church is talking so often about social concerns rather than spiritual ones. That distortion of Christian mission, so that the church is largely taken up with nuclear disarmament rather than the gospel of salvation, is another thing that would have been unthinkable 20, 30 years ago. Thirdly, a denial of Christ's uniqueness. You will know that in the Old Testament it's axiomatic that the religion that God had given to the Jewish people was of the true God, and that all the heathen religions were religions of no gods. You may like to turn to Jeremiah 10:11. Of course, Isaiah, in a sense, is most powerful about this, but this is rather a remarkable verse. Jeremiah 10:11, "The gods who did not make the heavens and the earth shall perish from the earth and from under the heavens." I said just in my notices that there was this cry 5 and 10 years ago amongst liberal theologians that God is dead. I think that's a very significant verse in the light of that. You see, the God of rationalism, the God of the Enlightenment, the God that I was taught by many lecturers at Cambridge and my theological college is obviously dead. The reason he is dead is that he never existed. I think of the headmaster of one of the biggest schools near here. He was a very keen young Christian in his teens. He's no longer a Christian today. He would tell you that he lost his faith in the war. Why did he lose his faith in the war? Well, I don't know, of course, the personal reasons why he lost his faith in the war. But I suggest that it was that the God he was taught about in his teens before the war was a God of endless benevolence. A God who was love, yes, but nothing else was said about him. And so we went into the war in 1940 and discovered the grim things that you find in war. It seemed that the God of his youth was hopelessly irrelevant, nothing to do with this at all. And he lost his faith. But you see, the God he'd believed in never existed. If you know the true God, you can live even through war, because you realize that the true God is altogether a greater, a more frightening God than the God of the Enlightenment and the God of popular 10 to 8 BBC religion. And of course those gods in the end die, because they don't match up to our needs, and we put them aside as we grow up. That's the reason, of course, why many Sunday school children put aside their belief as they grow up, because the God they were taught about never existed. They never heard about the real God. Now, this denial of Christ's uniqueness and of the God of the Bible is going rampant today, isn't it? The Berkshire Education Authority has taken the lead in saying that in schools in future, they will discuss all world religions rather than Christ's uniqueness. And that means that you will get in future idolatry on the rates. But it's very natural, isn't it, that you should have all the world religions. It seems so fair. And of course, to speak on in defense of the education authorities, the people who are devising these things, sitting behind their desks, wherever it is, they have no belief, most of them, that there's anything objective to do with these religions that is really, supernatural. They regard the world's religions as part of the study of anthropology. It's studying human cultures, and we have to say that other human cultures are very important, and we ought to study them. But you see, we would want to say that anthropology is no substitute for theology. That if you want to study God, it's no good studying the world religions, because there isn't a God there. The gods they worship are no gods. They're nonentities. If you want to worship and know the true God, then you must come to the revelation of God in the Old Testament and the New, because that is the only God who actually exists. Fourthly, the dilution of Christian commitment. I won't stop on this, but the illustration I used in Durham was those great old Sunday schools and Bible classes that belong to the past. How many there used to be? Those great Christian missions in the East End of London. How were they possible? Well, they're most of them boarded up today, aren't they? The Shaftesbury Society and the other missions have had to close most of them in the years after this war. Why did they have to close them? Well, one of the reasons was, of course, that you couldn't find Christians who would give up every Sunday and most evenings of the week. That's how the old great Crusader classes and Bible classes flourished, because somebody gave up almost their whole life to them. Christian commitment is talked about ad nauseam today, but it's very diluted, isn't it? The people are expected to do more than one thing a week, and that fairly small, they feel that they are being hardly used. And yet, as we've learnt in our own tiny little Sunday school, if it were not for the commitment of one or two people, like Lillian, it would be impossible to run it. And that commitment is, of course, costly. Well, there are four things that I mentioned, and you can think of many more, which show how, if you look back, you can't say to the church in the last part of the 20th century in the West how you've grown. You're bound to say how you shrunk. So we look back to those days when these Christian standards abounded, when people knew that Christ was the true Word of God, when people knew what Christian commitment meant, when people knew these things and would not be satisfied with any imitation. We look back to these things and we cry, verse 4, "Restore our fortunes, O Lord." Secondly, another balance in this, and very briefly on this one, God's work and ours. Now you see, if you look at verses 1 to 3, it's about the Lord doing great things. Quite clearly, as they look back, only God could have done them. Why, even the nations, the heathen nations, in verse 2, had to say, looking at Israel, "Your God has done great things for you. You couldn't have done it on your own." And yet you see in verses 4 to 6, he is entirely realistic. He realized that it's no good asking God to do these things unless man will work. And so he talks of the hardest work of all, the work of the farmer, in verse 5 and 6. Now we mustn't distort this truth, this balance. God's work is done through men. If you want to see God at work, you will normally see it through seeing men and women at work. So we mustn't say that if things are to happen, God must do it and we just darn tools. So when God works, men will work. That's clear. But the other way of looking at it is not quite so clear, is it? When Christian people work, it is not necessarily true to say that God is working. The 20th century, and particularly the last half, is an enormous period of activity. I'm not sure actually that it's just the 20th. The Victorians, of course, were known for immense activity. But we have caught the disease worse even than the Victorians. And the result is that we rush around in circles with our in-baskets full, and there is little time for prayer. I sometimes wonder whether there will be a tremendous swing of the pendulum at the end of the century in the next 10 years amongst keen Christians, and even the reawakening of monastic and enclosed communities. I personally think it'll be a great pity if there is, because I think there is no New Testament mandate for enclosed communities. But you see, there comes a time when people are rushing around in so many circles that they react against it and say, unless we pray, we're finished. And the reaction, humanly speaking, to that is to draw up communities of people who do nothing but pray. In London, we feel this particularly. We're always under pressure in London, aren't we? If there isn't one big Christian show, there's always another. I'm not against these great Christian occasions. I think, for example, that the next one, with the arrival of Louis Pallard, will probably be a great opportunity for evangelism. And yet, I wonder sometimes, as one great religious show follows another in London, whether all this activity is really bedded in prayer. I remember sitting in bed late on Sunday night some years ago, listening to the Wreath lectures that were repeated very late on a Sunday night. I've forgotten the name of the man who was doing them. He was an American, and he was saying that, as far as he could see, all the really important things happened. He had a picture of a bicycle wheel, and he said that most people think that important things happen if you start at the hub, because if you get to the hub, everything will go up the spokes or around the wheel. Whereas he pointed out in these Wreath lectures, and he gave many illustrations of it, that most of the important things in life had started out at the rim, at the end of one of the spokes, where nobody had noticed it. And because this thing had had within it a certain energy, a certain truthfulness, a certain carrying power, it had come down its spoke, been recognized by people, and gone through the other spokes. Now, what he was really saying was he was justifying the reaction against huge things, which has led to the slogan, small is beautiful. I think there's a very great lesson for Christians in this. Because the more you look into Christian history, the more you see that small is beautiful. That when people caught the 20th century bug, a feeling that unless you had a budget of $3 million, and unless you were making a great deal of noise, nothing was really happening. When people caught that bug, it wasn't clear 2 years later that anything very significant had happened. I think of the Prestatyn Conference, which was regarded as, by those who ran it, according to what they said in the slogan, as one of the most significant conferences of the century. But as I look back, it seems to me that very little came out of it at all. Whereas, in fact, if you look around, you will see that very often what actually happens in the church is that a group of people start to pray, and a tiny little acorn, to change the metaphor, is planted. And then, again, to change my metaphor, the news of this travels down to the center and out into all the spokes. I would suggest to you that that's something to think about very much in our own lives. Our duty is to spend time in prayer and only then to act. What we do when we pray, the action we then engage in may be very small at first, but it will grow one day into a great oak tree. Whereas if we actually forget to pray, of course there'll be a great deal of talk about prayer, and prayer letters will be issued by the million, but no one will actually use them. If we actually talk about prayer, we may find that we have a tremendous thing going on at the center, but 3 or 4 years later, it's very difficult to know that anything has happened. Well, whatever the truth is in what I say there and trying to illustrate it, I think you'll agree with me that there's a great deal of difference between human activity and divine activity, and we want both. And then very briefly, 2 more balances. There's a lovely balance here, isn't there, in verses 5 and 6, between sowing and reaping. Just a word on that. I think we ought to say from this passage and from the whole of the New Testament teaching, 2 things. First, that there is no reaping without sowing. Now, as I understand the evangelism in the Western world since D.L. Moody in the 1850s, most of the evangelism that has been publicly done has been done in a culture where some sowing had happened. In other words, most of the evangelism from Moody to Graham has been amongst the fringe members of the church. The evangelist was able to reap because many a Sunday school teacher had sowed. We're facing a crisis in evangelism today precisely because people want to reap when nobody has sowed. You can't reap, you see, as many of you know, amongst your pagan friends in the office and hospital today. You shrink from taking them along to an evangelistic rally when someone is going to issue a challenge or an appeal because you know very well that they're not ready for it. It reminds you that reaping without sowing is always impossible. Conversely, we have to say that there is no sowing without reaping. If we will sow in tears, wondering if anything is going on as we witness to our friends and seek to tell them the good news, we are told and comforted in Scripture that if there is any genuine sowing, there will always in the end be reaping. I find in those two sentences, and they're worth tucking down in your mind or on your cuff or wherever you take notes, they're worth taking away with you and meditating on today. If you're going for a walk with a friend through Regent Park this afternoon, tackle those two sentences. No reaping without sowing. If we only understood that, you see, a great deal of our evangelism today would be less frustrated. But also no sowing without reaping. If we believed that, a great deal of our work would be more encouraging. We should have greater hope. The psalmist imagines that if we are called to prayer, we shall also be called to work, and that work will be sowing and reaping. And he gives us a final balance, which is a very beautiful one, one between sorrow and joy. You see the tears in verse 5, and the weeping in verse 6, and yet you see the shouts of joy in verse 2, and the shouts of joy in verse 5, and the shouts of joy again in verse 6. What are we to say about that balance? Well, I think we can say two things. First, that there is no joy comparable to seeing God at work. There is no joy in all the world that is comparable to that. To give your life to Christian work as your first priority, to give your money and your prayers and your time to spreading the gospel amongst young people and old, promises you the most joyful life it's possible to have, let alone eternity. Because there is no greater joy for someone taking a children's class or a Christian union to see somebody turning to Christ. I'm sure some of you in Bethnal Green are looking forward to that great joy. Will there be any greater joy than to see that? There's nothing worth living for compared with that. It's lovely to see somebody who's led his first friend to Christ or been responsible for putting in an important chain in the link in the chain. I'm dyslexic this morning, sorry. The joy of that is so great, it makes us get down to Christian work with more vigor. But by the same token, we need to say that there is no work that is tougher, no work that is harder, no energy that leads more to tears than Christian work. You see, and we've been misled about this, haven't we? We've been given the impression in many quarters that shouts of joy is the norm for Christians on Monday morning and all the time. But of course that's nonsense, isn't it? You can't possibly live like that. You were never meant to. Because we're living in a fallen world and a rebellious world. Let me give you just one example of that. At our preacher's conference earlier this summer, we had a young man who's a really most gifted young evangelist. They tell me that if he keeps humble and keeps working, he's likely to be one of the most able evangelists of our generation. It was certainly exciting to hear stories from him of the work that God has given him to do. He's very young, barely in his early 20s. But you would perhaps have been surprised to hear that during the conference he came to me in private to tell me that he was tempted to give up the work. I inquired why. And he told me of the pressures and the perplexities and the agonies that he went through in his work. Well, I could only do one thing, couldn't I? And I turned him to 2 Corinthians 4, which is my last cross-reference, just to quite sure that you're with me and are awake. I love to hear the rustling of the leaves, 2 Corinthians 4, 7. But I want you to turn it up not just to assure me that you haven't gone into the land of Nod, but because it's such an important answer to someone who's in Christian work. as that young man was just beginning to experience. He told me something of the enormous perplexities and pressures that he'd found in his evangelistic missions, when everybody else, after he'd gone, was rejoicing in the fruit. He would tell me about his own personal weaknesses and how he didn't feel fit to do the work. Well, I didn't waste any time. I turned him immediately to 2 Corinthians 4, verse 7. We have this treasure in earthen vessels to show that the transcendent power belongs not to us, but to God. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Knocked down, as Phillips has it in his translation, but not knocked out. Now there is the answer, isn't it, that I gave him that day. Perhaps he needed to learn, as we need to learn constantly, that God is not going to allow us either to be or to experience constant joy, a constant sense of power, a constant sense of adequacy. We shall be reminded whenever we do Christian work that we are earthen vessels, and that the power belongs not to us and never will, but to God. And so we shall often be perplexed and persecuted and knocked down and sorrowful.